Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory, which is a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Justin O'Connor, who is the co-author with Sing Gu of Red Creative, Culture and Modernity in China. So welcome to the podcast.
Good morning, afternoon, evening.
I should say, this is a UK and Australia collaboration that we've got, so multiple time zones. This is a fascinating book, and I mean, there's a lot going on in the book. It covers, you know, like almost the kind of history of Chinese civilization. It's got, you know, questions about the creative economy. It's got an in-depth case study of Shanghai as this sort of paradigmatic, creative and contested place. So there's loads of things we can talk about. But to begin with, we should probably do a little bit of ground clearing, which is this idea about creativity. And I wonder if you could talk me through what kind of creativity means, why you're interested in writing about it, and why you're interested particularly in creativity in China.
Maybe I could get into it in a kind of biographical sense. That's how we start the book. And I've been working in cultural industries and then latterly creative industries since the early 90s, actually. So that's what I was interested in. I was working on cultural policy, mostly in cities, cultural industries policy, mostly in cities. I'd been based in Manchester, but also we ran a kind of a national UK organisation then from the late 90s. But also I've been working across Europe and various cities, you know, that were interested in cultural industries, creative clusters, these kind of things. So that was the background to it. I'd already been to St. Petersburg. I'd done some work in a kind of Manchester St. Petersburg project, and I'd already become aware of how different this kind of idea of creative industries was when it was transposed to a very different kind of context. And of course, you say that everybody kind of knows that, but the reality of it when it kind of hits you in the face is somewhat different. And but from 2004, I started to go to China, Shanghai specifically, and there was very interested, almost like on holiday. You know, I wasn't there as a professional thing. I went there to look around the country, and I began to see creative clusters popping up. And certainly in Shanghai, it was becoming a kind of the new thing, just coming from Hong Kong. So I was interested in, how's China going to deal with creativity? So that was the biographical start of the book. And what we tried to say at the beginning of that book is the idea of creativity, which was, you know, there was always a problem with the idea of creative industries for reasons we might go into. But the idea of creativity as some kind of force, power, capacity related to artistic creativity and also with historical change, it occurred to us very quickly that something was going on in China that kind of queried this pitch. And how the book starts is, what underlay this idea of creativity is going to change the world? How is it being specifically rolled out in the idea of creative industries and also the related creative cities, creative clusters, that kind of bundle of things? And we began to look at, first of all, what was it saying about China? What did China need to do to become creative, to benefit from this new creative economy, if you like? And if that was the case, what else was being wrapped up in that? And so, to cut a long story short, we began to see the idea of creativity, the creative industries, creative cities, creative classes, creative clusters, as actually very similar to older, let's say, imperialist or colonialist tropes, whereby the West represented the modern, the new, the next stage, and in this case, China, but, you know, the non-West represented something that needed to catch up, and it could only catch up if it got with the program. And people like the British Council or the various British consulates had the program. It was called Creative Industries and those kind of things. And really, China's best kind of hope was to begin to modernize, to adopt creative industries, because with this would go a new approach to bottom-up grassroots industries, new approach to cities. It would be about releasing the creativity of entrepreneurs on the ground. It would be about the state moving back or stepping back, and it would be perhaps somewhere the need for a kind of democracy, because only in democracy kind of free creative milieu thrive. So that was the starting point of the book, and we wanted to say what's problematic about that. So that's kind of how we got into it.
Yeah, and I mean, not to give the end in a way, but obviously there is a range of ways that these agendas play out that I guess kind of mirror what the British or indeed the American kind of models and approaches were saying, you know, would and should happen. And then there are a range of ways that those models just, you know, get completely transformed. And I guess one sort of route in to that is something you'd said earlier about the transformation of the agenda that became something like creative cities. And I suppose it's important to clear the ground with the story of how we got, from cultural industries to creative industries to then things like creative cities, creative clusters, creative classes even. And I mean, you mentioned the kind of biographical elements to that and your own work kind of shifting from cultural to creative. But it'd be good to know, I guess, kind of a bit more about how we went from the cultural to the creative.
Well, I think it's a word shift, and I've written about this in other occasions that, and I was kind of there when the Blair government and DCMS renamed it the Creative Industries, and it was kind of, oh right, they're not the cultural industries then. And in some, at first, it was kind of, well, that's just their name. It was a kind of a more of a, how do we say, sexy name. You know, cultural had links to the art, and culture, you know, had a certain kind of, it was linked to cultural policy and the arts policy and things like that. Whereas creative seemed much more open, much more popular, and more importantly, creative made a bridge between cultural industries, and the wider economy. So, of course, cultural industries were economic. For the cultural industries, you know, the big media corporations, the music industry, etc., etc., they were economic. But creative industries allowed this economic influence to kind of spread throughout the economy. And it did this by making culture is about, I'm not going to try and define it now, but the cultural industries made symbolic texts. You know, they made symbolic goods. They, you know, it's music, it's painting, it's literature or books or journals. The things that have a symbolic value, their economic value depends on their symbolic value. Creative is about a capacity or an input. So, of course, you know, the defining characteristic of the what were the cultural industries were that they were full of creatives, full of creative people, and that this capacity, in fact, could be could be embedded in other industries or could be catalytic for other industries. So creative was kind of uncoupled from culture, although it was clearly related to the idea of culture and the idea of artistic creativity. But it was kind of uncoupled from that and made into some kind of universally applicable economic capacity. And so you get outfits like NESTA, you know, the National Endowment for Science, Technology and the Arts, beginning to try and find out where creativity is right across the economy. And it results in some rather bizarre kind of definition. So a database specialist in a mining corporation is creative. There's a whole series of things going on with creative that move it away from culture, which seemed like a good idea at the time. You know, you speak to people like John Newbegin, who was, I think, head of Chris Smith, the minister of the culture minister's kind of research unit at the time. It was a kind of good way of doing it. It hit the Blairite zeitgeist, connected with the .com, you know, creatives, entrepreneurs, etc. But it caused such a massive confusion. And I challenge anybody in this listening to this podcast today to define what the difference between cultural industries and creative industries are. And you'll never get to the end of that, because there's no real definition of creative industries. And that's why everybody says cultural and creative industries, because that just covers it. So there's a problem with definition. And we saw that very much in East Asia generally, but also certainly in China, because immediately the idea of creative industries hits Singapore or Hong Kong or Taiwan and Shanghai and China itself. Immediately, they make a difference. Well, the cultural industries are these, and they kind of know what the cultural industries are. And creative industries are, well, they're business services, they're biotech, they're pharmaceuticals or other things. So it introduced a real mess into the context. So there is what we argue in the book, and we try and trace it in some detail, is in fact the idea of creative, which began as a kind of, you know, sexy new word, but it's same as culture, so who cares? That idea of creative industries really shifted the emphasis to a certain kind of economic discourse and a certain kind of, if you like, retooling of creative subjects in terms of you know, individual entrepreneurs of the self, cities as networks of entrepreneurs, and that the whole, if you like, the whole structure of industries would be these networks of self-creating entrepreneurs grouping together in creative milieus. There's a whole kind of discourse of this being rolled out. And we tried to show how that was essentially a neoliberal discourse. So, and it was one that when it got to East Asia, and certainly China, actually fell apart very quickly.
There's loads of ways we could kind of get into precisely that, actually. What happens when this discourse hits China and actually specific places in China. And maybe the way through that actually would be the case study of Shanghai, because it sort of is the backbone of the book, and you come back to it in several chapters. And it's a really useful illustration of the kind of evolution of maybe what we might describe as a kind of, you know, almost a cultural city to a creative city, and then to this kind of entrepreneurial set of creative clusters in a particular place. So could you introduce this kind of, I guess, sort of history of Shanghai that you try and chart quite early in the book, the kind of moments of Shanghai modern, and then maybe we'll move on and talk about how the city developed and became, sort of, to coin a phrase, creative.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the book actually began as focusing exclusively on Shanghai. I can't remember what we were going to call it. Something like, you know, Creative Shanghai or something. I don't know. Because you go, anybody who visits China, anybody who visits Shanghai first, we're quite familiar with the cityscape now, you know, lots of bright big buildings, you know, the iconic kind of Asian super city, mega city. We all know that it's now as familiar as, you know, Paris or New York or London even. You know, you Shanghai, you can put that Oriental Pearl TV tower on the you know, in silhouette, and people say, ah, Shanghai. So it's very famous now. And we thought, and the discourse emerging out of Shanghai itself, saw Shanghai as the modern Chinese city. It was in the vanguard of the rest of Chinese modernity. So just as it was kind of a glimpse into the future. The rest of China, of course, lots of poverty, still lots of people working on the land, but Shanghai represented the modern China. And this had a very long history. And I'm sure the listeners will know that Shanghai was, it did exist as a small city before, but essentially modern Shanghai was built by the British initially, latterly the French. It was built by Westerners who were given the port as a concession after the Second Opium War. So from about the 1860s onwards, it becomes a Western city, and it's got that famous kind of frontage along the Bund. People say it looks like Liverpool. It's got those kind of almost like a little encyclopedia of 19th century architectural forms kind of displayed on the Bund. So there we are. A lot of it's opium money, by the way, as well, but we won't go into that. So it was started by the West, and it became very rapidly one of the most modern cities in the world, actually. So, you know, you can really connect it with what was happening with Paris, with, you know, Haussmannization, the modernization through Baron Haussmann, or also in less top-down fashion, what was happening in London. So gas, water, electricity, kind of municipal socialism in some ways. But at the same time, it was expanding when there was a very large civil war in China, the Taiping Rebellion. So many thousands, well, many millions of Chinese people came to the city, both as workers and also as intellectuals, as the literati. So it was this space of increasingly a Chinese city. So it began as a kind of little Western placement, but increasingly it was a predominantly Chinese city run by the West. And it was separate from the Qing dynasty. So it became a kind of island of modernity. And it is where the word modern comes into China. And so it's seen as a space where China meets the West, meets the modern. And of course, out of it comes China's most modern city. And this is how it presented itself right up until the Communist Revolution in 1949. And it was kind of accepted as such by Mao, who punished the city effectively. He saw it as, you know, an enclave of imperialism, capitalism, colonialism, which of course it was. And he kept its economic engine revving, so to speak, but the surplus that it generated, which at one point I think was around 50 or 60% of China's GDP, the revenue it generated was taken by Beijing and used in different fashions. And so when the reforms start in in the initial reform starting 1978, Shanghai is held back for various reasons, which we talk about. It's seen as actually a problematic city. But from 1992, Deng Xiaoping relaunches Chinese modernization after Tiananmen, and we get what's called the green light given to Shanghai. And the green light is designated China's global city. It's going to be where China really opens up to the world, and it's going to be, you know, the kind of the modern shining centerpiece of the new China. So around that has built a whole narrative from the West of, you know, Shanghai's somebody wrote a book, The Gateway to Modernity, which was really the gateway to Western capitalism. And so the green light in 1992 was relaunching Chinese kind of westernization, Chinese capitalism. And this, if you get to Shanghai, you can see what a modern China might look like if Beijing allows it to extend in this way. That was the kind of myth behind it. And I think our problem was that we saw that it was a myth. It was being carefully controlled by Beijing. But Shanghai, there were other stories in Shanghai, other histories in Shanghai that were in play here. And we actually had to go back into the past again to uncover those narratives to get some sense around Shanghai. So in the end, it was about China, because, in fact, Shanghai is one part of China, obviously, but it didn't represent the most modern part of China. It represented a particular use of a city to engage with the West, to open up to the West, but it did so in a way that is very definitely part of the Chinese project of modernization, not some kind of proto-Western development.
Yeah, I mean, the book makes that point really well across the more detailed kind of historical and perhaps theoretical chapters on China. I'm particularly interested in what you'd said about, you know, on the one hand, Shanghai being this kind of emblem of, as you mentioned, you know, this quote-unquote gateway to modernity, but at the same time, the kind of control that Beijing had and the sort of very specific Chinese nature of the development there. And how did this play out in Shanghai as a kind of creative city then?
Well, I think the Shanghai government, the municipal government, was very keen to embrace the idea of creative industries. So the distinction was made that cultural industries were about culture, and therefore they should fall under, let's say, the culture ministry. And that, of course, is very much linked to what we would call the propaganda ministry. It's very much linked to, you know, images and ideas that the Communist Party deemed acceptable. And so it controlled, more or less, it controlled the culture system, if you like. The creative industries were immediately seen as, well, that they involve creativity, but they don't go into culture. They go into things like business services, entertainment. Video games was there for a little bit. Now it reverted to culture, but it's more about entrepreneurial culture, about you know, digital services, those kind of things. And so it was pushed to what they saw it as a kind of commercialization of creativity, seen not really related to cultural industries at all. But Shanghai were very taken up with ideas of creative cities and creative clusters, especially. And in fact, we'd met some Shanghai delegation in 2002, I think it was, came to Manchester, Liverpool. They did Manchester, Liverpool, London, various places. And what they were drawn to was the role of creative industries, creative clusters, if you like, in refurbishing old factories. So this is one of the strong things. So on the one hand, they've got this big innovation discourse that they realize they've got to go beyond basic manufacture, they've got to go upgrade, they've got to look to creativity as one route into that. Then you've got this other strand about reviving the old industrial buildings, because although, you know, Gordon Brown launching the creative Creative Industries kind of mapping document in 98 talks about the workshop of the world and how Britain was going to be a creative workshop of the world. And the whole creative industries agenda was very much about how we're going to outcompete the East, which is good at manufacture, good at big clunky top-down state stuff, but we're bottom-up creative stuff. So it was very much about, you know, the West kind of relaunching itself into, you know, keeping ahead of the game. But of course, Shanghai, across the 90s, had already itself had been deindustrialized. You know, a lot of that industry was kind of old, and a lot of it was being pushed out for pollution reasons as much as anything, but it was being pushed out to down into the Yangtze and down into the interior of China. And so Shanghai had a huge amount of old industrial stock, mostly from the 30s and 40s, some earlier, but it had this old industrial stock. What do you do with it? Get in the creatives. So it was, at first, it was very much a real estate thing. And it was creative industries, we can bring them into these buildings. So we chart that in one of the chapters, how that was actually done. So it was seen as a kind of a fix for Shanghai's real estate there. As well, they also sought, of course, new industries, new sources of growth in that way. But I think although this was very strong going up to about 2010, 2011, but around that time, they began to change, which we might talk a bit about later. But up till that time, the Western consultants going into China, you know, John Hawkins was there writing, I must say, pretty terrible books, Creative Ecosystems, which commissioned by the Chinese government, pretty thin. But also a whole range of Western consultants, British Council were in there, and all those kind of things, showing what creative clusters will do. You build the cluster, you get the creatives in, and you'll get this kind of bottom-up milieu of a creative city. And what we, I suppose, try and do, which makes some of the arguments complex at times, is that, you know, that was a Western model. But it was a Western model that actually itself had already become instrumentalized by the turn of the 20th century, 21st century, I should say. It was already closely linked to a real estate model of urban development that we all know and love today. And this suited the Chinese very well. What they found, of course, the Chinese, is that it's all right to build a creative cluster, but it's not as easy to get some creatives in. And that was really the problem. They found that the kind of creatives that went into these clusters, well, basically couldn't pay the rent because they weren't earning much money because they were small-scale, early artists, entrepreneurs in an emergent economy in that sense. So very quickly they got kicked out and they put Gap and people like that in. So the creative clusters tended, one or two exceptions, but the creative clusters tended to become effectively kind of trendy shopping, upmarket shopping, not shopping centres, but, you know, little gifts, little cafes, little things, kind of leisure shopping, if you like, aimed at first expats, or, you know, foreigners, and gradually, you know, the kind of wealthier Chinese or Shanghainese middle class. But they dropped out certainly by 2013, 14, they dropped out because, of course, the Shanghai government could build their own clusters and they didn't need to go through all that stuff. So we kind of chart the rise and the fall of creative clusters in Shanghai.
I mean, you sort of gestured towards this already, but what's the situation in Shanghai today? What would we describe as, I guess, the kind of the creative economy, but with specific Chinese characteristics? How has that agenda in Shanghai been, sort of adapted, almost kind of taken control of in the Chinese context?
Well, I think the Chinese discovered that they had a perfectly serviceable model and they didn't need to go through all this creative milieu, creative cluster, creative entrepreneur stuff, because this was really being sold you know, you read some authors and they, you know, the creative industries, you know, if you want the creative industries, China will have to change. And so creative industries were a catalyst or a Trojan horse or some such to actually make China into a kind of democratic or at least free market economy. And that clearly has not happened. And what China, I think, realized was very similar to what happened in South Korea, actually, which was the creativity arrived in East Asia at a moment just after the Asian financial crisis when the developmental state, this state that had grown up in the 50s and 60s and that had delivered huge economic growth in the Asian tigers, this was kind of on the back foot because of that Asian financial crisis. And so they, South Korea especially, began to kind of wind back the developmental state, you know, this very powerful state that directed economic development. It wound it back, introduced a lot of kind of neoliberal reforms, often being pushed there by the World Bank, etc. So it took that, but it didn't do that too much. It still kept those powers in place. What it did do was to apply them to the cultural sector and South Korea. And, you know, Hai Kyung Lee in King's College has some great, has written a very good book on this, that they always call it cultural industries. They don't have any truck with creative industries. It's you know, industries that make symbolic stuff, if you like, cultural stuff that K-pop and K-fashion, latterly, the soap operas, Korean films. And to do that, they didn't kind of wave a little wand of creativity, sprinkle creativity dust over people. They actually got the state in. They got huge research centres. They put massive capital investment in what they considered to be growth industries and rolled out, you know, the Korean wave. And I think that's exactly what China learned how to do. It learned very quickly that this the kind of the UK model was really just fairy dust. In fact, if you want to build up large world-beating global cultural corporations, you need a lot of money, you need big research, you need to buy up stuff, you need to invest. And that's how they began to do it domestically at first, you know, through various trial and errors. I mean, China is very good at trial and error. It experiments in certain parts. It can move, it can cut step back from policy, it can change policy because it has that longer capacity to do that. And in fact, what we also argue is that's how the United States operates. The United States doesn't operate creative economy stuff. It operates through trade policy, through state investment, through, you know, big private investments. But it actually gains its global market dominance, not just because it produces great stuff, which it does. It's got the whole apparatus to produce great stuff. But it's also controls infrastructure, distribution, et cetera, all these kind of things that we all know. And I think China recognized that and it's been looking at that. So the China model is very much like the South Korean model. It's very much like actually parts of Japan had done in the past, although Japan's slightly different. We're going to build an industry. And a culture industry is in some ways quite similar to other industries if you want to just go for growth. So it's and Shanghai, you can see that in Shanghai. Their creative clusters now aren't, you know, a little factory with a nice cafe. They're huge kind of industrial parks where millions and millions of renminbi are thrown at television production or music production or films, TV, etc. Or games, you know. And they're developing those. They've become much more sophisticated in understanding what the markets are, what industries are, et cetera, et cetera. So it's going for, you know, global domination or at least domination of the Belt and Road world. So they've got an industrial policy for culture, if you like, that bears no relation to the sort of stuff that's coming out of the UK, which essentially is PR and headsets, isn't it, really?
I mean, that's quite a nice moment to sort of conclude the discussion of the book. I mean, we've only scratched the surface of, as I say, you know, the history of China that's in the book, the discussion of, I guess, kind of, you know, culture more generally in China, and indeed the discussion of Shanghai in a lot more detail. But just as a sort of concluding question, you mentioned the kind of, you know, comparisons with America and then the end of kind of the British creative industries model. Is this stuff you're going to be looking at in future work, or are you kind of working on completely different things for your next set of projects?
I'm working on two things that come from that, I suppose. One, I'm interested in some of the geopolitical aspects of China and alternative modernities, because a lot of the chapters, the earlier chapters, really go back into the 19th century and some even before that, and look at where China came from with a different view of things. So I'm very interested now in, given the fact that we're now in a pretty much a much more hotter war situation than we were when in 2004, when everybody was going to be happy and the world was going to converge. The world's not going to converge at the moment. And so understanding some of that has been important, is something I'm going to work on. At the same time, I'm looking at retracing the steps back to the days of the cultural industries and perhaps even before then, and start rethinking in a Western perspective, as I say, rethinking the idea of culture and cultural policies from ground zero. So that's it's going to be called the Art of Reconstruction. So that's going to be looking back to the New Deal, but also beyond that, back to, you know, post-slavery, etc., which didn't end well, I know. But it's really looking back, you know, we need to go back to some of what is the purpose of culture, why should it be valued, and what kind of policy should come from that. And that, again, that connects us to some of the questions we asked about China, going back to what China did at the end of the 19th century. But we're asking what use is culture, and how might we strengthen it in terms of cultural policy? And that has to take into account what's happened, you know, in the last 40 or 50 years, the rise in the economic weight of culture in that way, cultural industries and other forms. But we think, we're thinking it's got to be redefined using, if you like, heterodox economics and other kind of ways of looking at things. So that's kind of where a lot of the ideas from the China book will end up. Just finally, a very slight odd one is some of that I want to kind of go back over in terms of a book on Joy Division, which may fill many people with dread, but it's really looking at Joy Division and Manchester. It's really looking at Joy Division and the origins of the idea of the creative city. So that's for next year.